And welcome back to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And joining me now is Jill Weimer. Thanks for being with us. She was recently awarded a $1.75 million, almost $2 million grant to fund her research in intracellular trafficking in neurological disorders.
Yep.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, it is.
Welcome to Innovation. So explain it. Bring it to my level.
Sure. So our lab, most of us know that inside your brain you have these cells called neurons. They communicate with their neighboring cells similar to a lamp in your house. So they use an electrical signal to relay signals between the two cells. And sometimes those signals or those cords have to pass a very long distance. So for instance, you have an axon from one of these nerves in your spinal cord that goes from the tip of your spinal cord down to the end of your big toe. So very long distance. And so these cells are unique in that they have to come up with ways to transport things down those very, very long distances. So our lab looks at what are the mechanisms that they use for transporting that cargo over those long distances. And that's really the crux of this grant.
That's the crux of it. And mm-hmm. are there diseases associated with
yep.
it, disorders?
Yep. So the complex that we're focused on contains a protein that's mutated in a very rare pediatric neurological disorder. It's a form of Batten's disease. So in this particular disease, the kids, the cells, the lysosomes, are garbage disposals within our neurons, get filled up with junk. So they can't chew up this garbage or recycle these proteins. And that in turn leads to death of these neurons. So these kids usually are born fairly normal, usually around the age of 18 months to 1 year of life. In this particular form of the disease, they start to have visual problems, seizures. They never reach the same cognitive milestones that a child their same age might meet. They develop motor impairment, and they usually die between the ages of about 5 and 10 years old. So a very devastating disease, a horrible thing for the families to go through, for the children to go through. So the work that we do is really understanding what the disease is happening in the disease, and how could we actually design therapies that are targeted to some of these proteins to hopefully restore or prevent the disease from occurring.
From occurring at all, or from
Kind of delaying the progression of the disease, okay. probably would be our first step. With these rare genetic disorders that occur during neurodevelopment, it's really hard to come up with a cure so much as a way to actually prevent them once you recognize that they're there. So
okay, so then it's early diagnosis.
Yep. That's a combination. A lot of times these particular genes aren't included on newborn screening panels. So usually it's by knowing that someone in your family has had this disease, or that you might be at a higher risk of your children having one of these diseases, that you actually do or request the genetic diagnosis. Most of the parents who actually have children with these diseases, the kids actually develop symptoms before they even look for genetic diagnosis. So they wouldn't even know to suspect that this is going to happen to their children.
Hmm. So let's then go back to exactly what you kind of broadly mm-hmm. explained your study. So what's now the first step, the next step, I
yeah.
guess, in
so,
this?
So the way that we think that these cargo are being moved up and down these axons are that imagine that your neurons, these axons, actually have a railroad track inside of them. And so they have train cars that are going both down to the synapse and then back to the cell body to kind of take cargo down to where it needs to be, and then things back to the cell body to need to be recycled. And so the proteins that are involved in this particular disease form the train cars that might sit on that railroad track. And so what we're trying to understand is, can we actually bypass the actual gene mutation? So we know that we probably will have very slim chances of actually restoring the gene that's defected in this disease, but could we actually restore some of those train cars in the railroad tracks that they're on so that most of the cargo is able to be transported correctly? Because our idea is that if we can restore the transport of those train cars, we might be able to actually rescue the neuron from dying.
Okay, and then develop treatments?
Yep. So we are actually screening a number of drugs. We are fortunate that we have a mouse model of this disease, so we can actually screen a number of drug compounds in these mice. The mice develop similar behavioral deficits, motor performance deficits, as the patients, the human patients would. And so we actually treat the mice with the drug compounds and then see whether we can improve some of these behavioral outcomes, and then also look at their brain at the end of the study and see whether we've been able to rescue some of the neurons and some of the pathological changes that we would see associated with the disease.
So you're not taking it yet to a clinical?
No. Actually, we've entered in some discussions about what the next step would be. I think that a lot of times we miss the important critical step that taking something from the bench to the bedside is a very long process, and we need to make sure that all of our ducks are in a row. So we have to do the preclinical trials in mice before we'd actually either move to a larger organism or into humans with the efficacy studies that we would do in humans. So we're several years away from the point where we would actually go into humans with the therapy.
So if a child is diagnosed with Batten's disease, mm-hmm. what is the treatment now?
Right now, the treatment is to kind of control some of those symptoms that I mentioned. So they're very effective drugs for treating the seizures. A lot of the kids actually develop things like disruption in their circadian rhythm or their sleep patterns. And so there's drugs that you can use to control that. There are drugs that can help with some of the motor movement disorders. As they get towards the end stages of the diseases, many of the children have to be intubated. They're not getting proper nutrition. So they're intubated. They're given a feeding tube. So there are some treatments that can control some of the symptoms, but many of those, or most of those, do not in any way delay the progression of the disease. They just kind of control what's happening to the child in the moment.
So if then there are therapeutics developed to delay the progression mm-hmm. of the disease, are we talking long term, or are we just...
Yeah, and I think the hope is that these treatments would delay the disease progression for a number of years. I think the conversations that we've been having more recently, myself, Dr. Michael Kruer, and Dr. David Pierce at Sanford all actually work on Batten's disease, is taking more of a strategy similar to what folks employ in the cancer field, where you don't cure cancer or treat cancer with just one drug. You actually have a combination regimen that you give to a cancer patient that's able to tackle the cancer from multiple different angles. And so with these neurological disorders, we're taking a similar approach, where could we actually target one drug that might help rescue the neurons, and another that might dampen the immune response that you see in the patients, and another that might be able to overcome some of the genetic defects. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of our strategy right now, is maybe one rescues a few years, another one adds a couple more years, so that in combination we would actually get these kids to be living a lot longer, and not only living longer, but living a healthier lifestyle.
And that was my next question, to go into the genetics part of it, the genetic sequencing part mm-hmm. of it, and how that plays a role.
Yep. So
in your study.
These diseases, the one that I study is actually a gene called CLN6. Batten's disease is actually a family of diseases that have as many as 14 different genes that have been associated with this family of disease. And so depending on which genetic mutation you have, it causes an earlier age of onset or a later age of onset. So there are some genes that actually cause an infantile. So right after birth, the baby starts to develop some of the defects, the neurological defects. There are other forms of Batten's disease that actually don't start until adulthood. So you don't see any symptoms until 30, 40 years of age. So depending on the genetics, and so the push within the larger Batten's disease field is clear methodologies for physicians in the actual diagnosis, so that the earlier we are able to diagnose these kids when therapeutics come on board, the earlier we'll be able to treat them. So we would rather start somebody on a treatment before they show any symptoms mm-hmm. and keep them at that state, rather than wait until they've actually shown some signs of the disease. Maybe they're having seizures or are already starting to go blind before we start them on the drug treatment.
So is this something then we would see in the, you know, newborn panel?
So actually there's been a big push to include some of these genes on the newborn panel screening. Unfortunately, the variant that I work on is actually not very common in the United States. In fact, right now there are only 2 patients in the United States that we know of that have mutations in this gene. It's more common in the Middle East, and Costa Rica actually has a high patient prevalence of this.
Why? Why there?
It's because of the genetic inbreeding that you see in some of those populations, mm-hmm. And so that those genes are propagated. So the more common forms in the United States are actually the juvenile form that David Pierce's lab works on, and then the infantile and late infantile forms. And so there's more of a push to get those included on the newborn panel screening. There are countries where there are very high prevalence rates of Batten's disease. So for instance, Northern Europe, in the Scandinavian countries, actually have a very high prevalence of multiple forms of Batten's disease, and they actually do include these genes on their newborn panel screening. So it's more of a push with a lot of these rare diseases, you know, kind of the cost of including them on the panel versus how many patients we actually see in the United States with these gene mutations.
So are there other researchers then studying the same thing you are?
So the one that I work on, there's only probably about two other scientists in the whole world that actually work on this particular gene. Mm-hmm. The concept of this vesicular transport and moving of these vesicles up and down axons is actually a huge field. And so, for instance, Tom Sudhoff won the Nobel Prize this year for actually his work in understanding how these vesicles move within axons and in the nervous system. And so it's a big field for the vesicular trafficking side, but a very small side field for the side of the Batten's disease research.
And how did you select this?
So I actually was fortunate that I did my doctoral work at the University of Rochester in upstate New York, and David Pierce was my co-advisor. So I actually started out in Alzheimer's disease and then got interested in his lab, switched over, did my PhD with him. Then I actually went and did my fellowship at the University of North Carolina in a developmental neuroscience lab. And while I was there, Dave calls me up and he says, "Hey, I'm coming to Samford. I'm building this team of folks centered around children's and pediatric research, and I'd like you to come along as a team and start your lab there." So I came back, and I actually, when I set up my lab, my primary focus was more on developmental neuroscience and some of the things that might be related to autism and schizophrenia development. And we still work on those things in the lab, but this Batten's disease project really took off, and so it's where I focused a lot of my efforts over the last couple of years.
And so, I mean, there's all of this competition for funding and
yes.
for research dollars.
Yes.
How did you land this, do you think?
I would actually say part luck, part hard work. the federal funding over the last couple of years has really, really tightened down, and it's become very, very competitive. I would say sort of the best advice I've been given is be persistent, always be working on something, and make yourself stand apart from other people in the way that you approach your science and the questions that you're asking, so that you're, when you go up for review for these large grants, that people can say, "Hey, this is something that not only has never been done before and it needs to be done, but also this is the ideal person to do this project."
And so what do you think, where is this going to take you over the next 5 years?
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where this project goes.
I can't wait to find out,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, we've started, one whole section of my lab is really focused on the preclinical screening of compounds that might target towards this signaling complex. So we have a number of studies that are going in that direction. I would hope that in 3 or 4 years time, we would actually be closer to taking one of those into the clinic and treating patients would be the ideal situation. But we, like I mentioned, don't want to be hasty in moving one of those things forward that's not going to be critically evaluated and the most beneficial for the patients that we would be treating. So,
and you said there's only maybe two others that are doing the same kind of research. Do you collaborate?
Yep, actually we do. It's a very small field, and so it's one of those areas that you can't not talk to each other. So the Batten's disease field actually as a whole is very collaborative. I can call up one of the primary labs that works on our particular protein is in Germany, and I can call up that lab and say, "Hey, you know, you got some tools in your tool belt that I really need," and he'll ship them over and we'll have access to those resources. So it's great. I actually collaborate with a number of scientists around the United States and in Europe that are working on Batten's disease and have been very helpful at moving my science forward.
Okay. But in general, how common is Batten's disease?
So worldwide, it's about 1 in every 100,000 live births. In the United States and Northern Europe, where you see the most prevalence of this juvenile form, mm-hmm. it's about 1 in every 12,500 live births. So fairly rare.
Mm-hmm. We are out of time.
Oh,
I know.
So
it went quick. So Jill, thank you for taking time and coming.
Much.
And I look forward to having you back and have regular updates.
Excellent. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Jill Weimer with Samford.